the Triathlon Show 411. Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview Bas van Horen. Bas is a sports scientist, sports science consultant, and a runner with multiple national championship medals and a 10k PB of 28:41. And in this interview, we discuss a number of topics that he has researched, including practical applications of these findings as well. Some of the topics we cover include cooldowns, treadmill versus outdoor running, older athletes that perform at a really high level, strength and conditioning, science and application, devices and technology, and quite a few more bits and pieces. But before we get into the interview, big thanks to our sponsors, Form. The Form Smart Swim Goggles give you real-time feedback in your swim training right on the goggle lens, including splits, pace, stroke rate, and heart rate. This means that you can execute your swim workouts better and get a better idea of your ability to hold certain paces and stroke rates and understand when and why you start to slow down. The best thing is that you can see and interpret this data in real time in the session, so it's actionable and it can help you right then and there. You don't have to go into the workout data after. You can understand right as you're working on your swim. Also, it adds more fun and engagement to swim training, especially if you're swimming solo. And you can get 15% off the goggles with the code TTS15 on formswim.com/TTS. And thank you to Zenate. The Zenate indoor swim trainer allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency even when you're short on time. It's a great tool for busy athletes because you can do a quality workout in just 15 minutes at home, even on days when you don't have time to get to the pool. And it is a good complement to pool and open water swimming, as it allows you to focus specifically on key aspects of your swimming, like your catch or your power, or you can isolate these more easily than you can in the water. You can try the Zenate risk-free for up to 30 days, so if you don't love it, just send it back, and you can get 20% off your first order on zenatesuintrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, here's the interview with Bas van Horen. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Bas. How are you doing?
Hello, Michael. Thanks a lot for inviting me. I'm happy to be on the show.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. Let's start with an introduction. Can you tell us more about who you are?
Yeah, sure. So I'm working primarily at the University of Maastricht at the Department of Nutrition and Movement Sciences. So that's in the Netherlands, for those who don't know. I'm doing research there, quite a lot of different topics. I guess we will cover a few of them later on, but most of them are related somehow to running. In addition to the work at the university, I also work at a governmental organization, which is called Top Sport Topics. So it's a sort of consultancy-based job that I'm doing there. So if coaches, like national level coaches, have a question about, let's say, should they do altitude training? Should they use some kind of nutritional supplement? What strength exercise should they be doing? How should they program jumps, whatever? Then I have to delve into the literature and try and provide an evidence-based answer, which is also something I really enjoy. And finally, I'm also working at a wearable tech company. It's called Arion in Eindhoven, also in the Netherlands. And they make wearable technology, so pressure-sensitive insoles, to measure a variety of metrics during running. And also in the future, we're also expanding this to some other movements. So that's sort of a very brief summary of the work I'm doing.
Yeah, you got a lot of lots of irons in the fire. And I know that you're also a pretty handy runner yourself. So what is your own athletic background like?
Yeah, true. Well, I guess I just started at a high school cross someday, and there I found out I was quite a good runner. And then I had to, I could go to the sort of national cross-country school championships, and also there I think I finished third place without too much training, essentially. Well, basically no running training, so I was just doing some football and some volleyball I did in the past. And then I just found out, well, actually, it's perhaps something I like doing and I'm good at it. So then I gradually picked up running more and more. And yeah, I just ramped up the training volume over time. The intensity also changed quite a bit over time. And I just got better and better at it. And I still like it and I'm still competing. And I still hope I can go for a few years and try and improve some PBs, get some national titles, participate at some, well, perhaps a European championship. So it's still going well.
Nice. Yeah. So, as you said, you have done research in a lot of different topics, more or less related to running. And I looked through your ResearchGate profile and your publications, and I picked a few topics that I want to basically ask you for a bit of an overview about. And they're all related to some things that you have published. And so I guess the first one that I wanted to start with was about cooldowns. So can you just give an overview of the research that you did there and what you found, and then give some practical recommendations for the listeners?
Yeah, of course. So perhaps it's nice to also start with why I did that. This is a review I did, so like a very extensive review. And it's also something from my own practical background as an athlete. And I used to also do some strength conditioning coaching. And then, of course, a lot of people and coaches, they just regularly do a cool down, including myself. And at some point, I was just wondering, do we actually have any evidence that cooldowns are effective? Because everyone's saying you should do a cooldown because you recover better, you perform better. But I was just wondering about the scientific evidence. And I just started working on a review, and it turned out to be quite nice. So eventually, they decided to submit it for publication. But also something I found out during the review, during the whole process, is that if you have a simple question like, do we recover faster, it's actually quite tricky to try and answer that question, because what do we find as recovery, for example? There are many metrics that we can measure to sort of define recovery. We can just ask people, do you feel better after a cool down, which is a subjective measure of recovery. We can ask them, do you feel less muscle soreness, which is also somehow a subjective measure. We can also try and get more objective measures, such as actual muscle damage from biopsies. We can measure lactate in blood or in muscle tissue, hormone concentrations. There's a lot of things we can measure. And then if we summarize all those findings, which was quite surprising to me, we actually don't really see very pronounced benefits on all of these objective metrics if you do a cool down as compared to not doing any cool down after exercise. And of course, we also looked at some other metrics such as performance, which is sort of a more overarching metric that incorporates all these different objective measures that would influence, in the end, of course, also recovery. And there also we saw sort of similar effects. So we separated performance, or we looked at performance in two different ways. So we looked at same-day performance and next day performance. So same day performance is something that's mostly relevant for elite athletes that would be performing multiple training sessions or competitions on the same day. And what we saw there is that, again, the most likely effect was that there is no beneficial effect of doing a cool down on same day performance if that's going to happen, let's say, 4 hours later. And if any effect is going to happen, it's most likely to be going to be negative. So our recommendation there is, well, it's probably going to be just too much extra effort if you would do a cool down. If you have to perform again on the same day, it's probably better not to do a cool down, because you either have no benefit or it's going to be a negative effect. And for next day performance, again, we saw it's most likely to not have any effects. But there were also some indications that it might, for some individuals, have a slight positive effect. So there you could argue, well, if it's not going to harm you, it might have some slight benefits. So some other markers we looked at are adaptive response. So we know from quite some other recovery modalities, such as cold water immersion, and also if you use a lot of vitamins, vitamin C specifically, that you are actually suppressing your sort of adaptive signaling pathways. And we were wondering if something similar might happen during a cool down. So theoretically, if you would improve recovery, you might take away some of the adaptive response for the body to increase strength, for example, increase endurance adaptations. But we actually saw a trend towards the opposite there. So if people regularly did a cool down, they actually improved their performance slightly more, which is sort of a good way, because then it means if you do a cool down, you just get in a bit extra volume, for example, which might improve your performance. But it also suggests that what we're actually doing is not really helping us recover better. It's just extra training, essentially, which is sort of supporting what we've been finding in the review so far.
That's kind of from a practical perspective, that's the way I've been thinking about it, even before reading your review, that like I haven't seen cooldowns in themselves providing extra value, but it's just like you have a certain amount of volume that you want to achieve. And if you go, for example, and want to do a workout on the track, let's take my personal example. I live about 12 minutes from the track. I can run to the track, do a little bit of extra warm up, get in 20 minutes of warming up, do a workout on the track, and then run home. And then I get my, let's say, 1 hour or 1 hour, 10 minute run. But if I wanted to do it, if I wanted to just, I don't know, take a taxi home instead, and over time that adds up to doing less volume. And then, so it's not so much that the cooldown itself is helping me, but the extra volume that I'm getting in is helping.
Yeah, exactly. I'm doing exactly the same. So I also run to the track, do my track workout, and then I just make an extra loop a little bit to have some extra mileage in. But it's not really because I'm thinking I'm recovering better, because I know from the research, but just for extra mileage indeed.
Yeah. But then it's interesting to look at the another example, which would be cycling then. So I have some workouts that are just like, let's say, high intensity intervals, and I'm perfectly happy to do a high intensity interval session and then finish with no cool down. Basically, if I do something like 10 by 2 minutes on, 2 minutes off, then the final 2 minutes off is the only thing I do. I don't do 10 minutes extra easy riding afterwards necessarily. I do sometimes when I just want the volume, but I don't have to do it if I have 1 hour to do a workout and the workout is scheduled to finish on 1 hour.
Yeah, and I think that's an important one, because in my experience, a lot of people have, of course, a very limited time period during which they can do a workout. And then I don't think they should be devoting, like, let's say, 15 minutes to a cool down, because they can then better probably use their time to just do, let's say you have an hour to do, I don't know, 55 minutes of just work, basically. And then you might do a 5 minute cool down just to, well, basically just sweat out a little bit. And so you're not sweating while you're stepping into the shower or something. The evidence doesn't really support that we should be doing like a very extensive cool down to then make sure we recover better for a next session, because that's not going to happen, at least not for most people.
Right. Yeah. So let's move on to the next topic, which I think is also very interesting and relevant for a lot of people, especially now as we're heading into winter, which is treadmill versus outdoor running. So this is another area where you've done quite a bit of research, both looking at things like how speed is or is not equivalent between the two, and things like how the running biomechanics might be different. So can you give us an overview again of what is the work that you've done there and what are the practical applications?
Yeah, of course. So again, it's motivated by the same idea, which is a lot of coaches, athletes, they're just commenting like, you shouldn't run on treadmill because then you have to push off less. Or if you do run on a treadmill, you put it on a 1% incline to make sure you have the same physiological stimulus, essentially. So again, something I found interesting to delve into the literature to see what's supported there and what isn't. So if we start with the physiology, so we did an extensive review there, and something I found quite interesting as well that we found is there is just one study among, I don't know, 20 studies that we might have included, I don't know the exact number, that showed if you put the treadmill to 1% incline, you better match the physiological demands with treadmill running compared to overground running. So the oxygen consumption is specifically what we're talking about. But these other 19 studies, they actually found you get the same effect in treadmill running, so the same physiological stimulus, if you just put the treadmill inclination to 0%, so no gradient at all. So our recommendation, therefore, is also that you actually don't need to put the treadmill inclination to 1%, and you can just keep it to 0%, and then you have the same physiological demand as compared to off-grid running. And then some listeners might wonder, well, doesn't that depend on speed? So the faster you run over ground, of course, the more wind resistance or wind drag you have. And of course, that's correct. We also did, which is called a meta-regression analysis, to see if the effect would change with increases in speed. But at least up to speeds up to 16 kilometers per hour, we didn't find that a 1% incline would be better than a 0% inclination. So our suggestion, again, is if you're a recreational runner, which might be running up to, say, something like 16 kilometers per hour, it's probably not required to put the treadmill inclination to 1%, and you can just leave it to 0%, because that will give you the same physiological demand as you would have in off-ground running.
Yeah, 16 kilometers an hour, that would be roughly, I think off the top of my head, 3:45 per kilometer, more or less, something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so it's for the listeners, it's about 118, 119 half marathon pace. So in that region, if you're below that, then that would you would fall in that category of not being affected. That is really interesting because I have for a long time been of the belief that you want to have a 1% grade. So I learned something new there for sure. What about the biomechanics? Is there any difference there?
There are very small, subtle differences. So again, we also did meta-analysis, which is essentially just statistically summarizing all of the evidence that has been conducted to date. And we found some very small differences, but they're so small that we are really unsure if they're relevant at all. So just to give an example for contact time, if I remember correctly, it was longer. I'm not sure. I think it was longer by 5 milliseconds on a treadmill as compared to all ground running. And a normal contact time is, let's say, for a recreational runner might be 250, 280 milliseconds. So it's a really small difference that you have on a treadmill. And it's within the sort of typical error of measurement that we actually have within most measurements. So if we would measure someone twice with a different device, we would also have such a difference. So and we see sort of similar effects for most of these outcomes, which suggests, indeed, if you're running on a treadmill, it's in most situations, essentially, it provides the same biomechanics as compared to overground running. But there are some situations in which your running technique, your running biomechanics might be a bit different. And there are two primary factors for this. One is that you're not accustomed to treadmill running. And we provide some guidelines based on the evidence there that if you just, which is mostly relevant for physios, I guess, but if you would do a gait analysis, so an analysis of running technique on a treadmill, it might help to give people at least 8 minutes of time to get just used to the treadmill, because then we see that the running kinematics, so running technique essentially gets very close to what they're using over ground. And if you would be measuring it within the first minute, for example, people are still getting used to the treadmill, and then you might observe Yes, some differences in technique on the treadmill that are not actually reflective of overground running. So just give sufficient time to get accustomed to the treadmill. So that would be my first advice. And then a second one, which is a bit more tricky to match, is the stiffness of the treadmill. So we also did a very big study where we investigated the surface stiffness of the belt, essentially, and compared the treadmill surface stiffness to other overground surfaces, just such as concrete, where most people are running, but also to a track or artificial turf. And then we found that most treadmills have a surface stiffness that's much more comparable to artificial turf as compared to concrete. So they're basically not as stiff as concrete, for example. And we know that the body's quite smart. So if you run on a very stiff surface, your body will decrease the leg stiffness. And if you run on a very compliant stiffness, your body will increase the leg stiffness. So by manipulating or by because the surface stiffness of the treadmills is a bit different to the typical concrete surface, of course, then the overground or the treadmill running biomechanics might also differ slightly. So if you would want treadmill to be a perfect match of your overground concrete surface, of course, you would need to buy a treadmill with a very stiff and rigid surface, which are typically the very expensive clinical ones. And if you just go to the typical gyms, they don't have a really rigid surface, so it's a bit more compliant. So of course, that's also then going to influence the way in which you run.
Yeah. So what would you say in practical terms for you, or for if you're consulting with an athlete or coaching an athlete, do you recommend treadmill running depending on things like weather or what type of workout they're doing if they don't have access to a track, for example? Or yeah, what can the listeners take away?
Yeah, so the biomechanics suggest, indeed, you don't need to push off less, for example, on a treadmill. That's also a common myth. If you wouldn't, you just would be thrown to the back with a treadmill. So you have to push off to an equal amount. Some subtle things there that we can discuss another time. I guess that's not too relevant for the listener. So overall, you can just say you have to push up to an equal amount. The energy cost is also approximately equal, at least at these lower speeds. So you don't need to put the treadmill to this 1% incline, so you can just run normally on the treadmill essentially, and then it's going to be an effective stimulus indeed physiologically and biomechanically, very similar to what you would have in overground running. So from that perspective, it's indeed quite an effective tool if it's rainy outside or if it's snowing, whatever, it's dark, to train on the treadmill. I don't think there's research to support this, but my personal guess is that it's probably not going to learn you to pace as well as overground running, because you just set the pace and you keep running, and overground running, you have to pace yourself a bit more essentially. So there I wouldn't recommend it. So overall, I think if you just alternate it with overground running, it might actually be quite a nice tool to still get in the mileage. It might help you to control intensities to some extent a little bit better. So if for like the Norwegian methods or threshold training, you can just get lactate measurements on the treadmill. You can just have the equipment next to you. So these are some sort of practical considerations that would also help in a treadmill setting. So for some workouts, indeed, it might actually be quite handy to use a treadmill.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think one problem that you have in some workouts, especially if you have active recoveries between harder intervals and maybe longer intervals as well with treadmill running, is that depending on the gym as well, of course, and the ventilation, the core body temperature can get quite high when you don't have the cooling that you have when you're actually moving or you have air moving around you. So that's one thing that I found personally, at least, that if I'm doing longer intervals with shorter recoveries, and the recoveries are jogs rather than passive recoveries, I tend to overheat. So I prefer to do those kinds of workouts outdoors if I have a chance. But shorter intervals with passive recoveries are fine to do from a body temperature, core body temperature perspective as well on the treadmill. But that's something to consider depending on, I think, the ventilation and temperature of the gym that you're in.
Yeah, absolutely agree. And also just the speed of some treadmills can take it. At least it feels long to get to a certain speed. If you're running at 20 kilometers per hour, it might take a few seconds to get there. And sometimes you just want to get up that speed in a few steps as well.
Yeah, definitely. All right, so let's move on to the topic of older athletes. You have a couple of interesting case studies with actually some world-class older athletes that have achieved world records in things like middle distance running. So can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, we're quite lucky actually to have two world-class master athletes just living sort of next door to the university here. And I've always wanted to investigate them, and perhaps we can still do that sort of longitudinally. But at some point, we just decided, okay, let's measure them and just see if we can see some exceptional physiological parameters that you would expect, of course, for their age performances. So one of the athletes we were measuring is called Hans Meets. He's a 75-year-old, at least at the time we were doing the measurements, athlete. And he has multiple world records at his 8-year groups in the middle-long distances, so 800 meters most prominently. And the second athlete we were measuring is called Joost Schoonbrood. He's 71 at the time of the measurements. And he's a marathon runner and also ultra marathon runner. So they're quite a bit different distances, but both of them are runners.
And can you let us know what are the world records for the 800 in the first case and the marathon in the second case?
To be honest, I don't know from the top of my head. I would need to check. No, I'm sorry.
I'll put the link to the papers in the show notes so listeners can go and have a look, and I'll try to look it up and read it out in the outro of this episode after the interview.
I think they're mentioned in the paper, so that should be able to find it there. And if you can find them, that would be perfect.
So do go on. What did you find about their physiologies?
So if we start with Hans Meets, so we found at 75 years of age, he still had a VO2max of 50.5 milliliters per kilo per minute. So that's the highest VO2max we ever recorded, or anyone ever recorded at that age. So of course, that's sort of something you would expect for a world-class athlete, but it's still really impressive to see those numbers at that age. And also, I guess for some people, quite comforting that with sufficient training, you might still achieve those numbers at that age. So I think that's something also for me. I'm looking out for the long run if I can sort of maintain my VO2max at those numbers at that age as well. Then we also found for Hans, he has quite a large anaerobic speed reserve. So essentially capability to increase his running speed above his VO2max running speed, which is also probably one of the reasons why he is so good at the 800 meters, where you are running a lot with above your VO2max or around your VO2max speed. And you have to have this acceleration capability in the last 200 meters, for example. So that's, again, supporting why he is so good. And for Yo, we looked at some slightly different metrics. So we also measured his VO2 max, and I think that was 46.9, if I remember correctly. So also very high for that age group still. Not the highest value ever recorded, but again, it's something you might also not really expect for a marathon runner. Instead, what we found was that his efficiency, so running economies, was very exceptional. So I'm not saying it's the best value ever recorded, but it was very low oxygen cost. So it is also probably in combination with his still quite high VO2 max value, explaining why he has been able to break the world record. What's quite interesting there is also we compared his values to the previous world record holder, which some, I think, Canadian colleagues measured. And indeed, we saw the VO2 max was quite similar, but the running economy from Yo was quite substantially better, which might be explained by his high running volume. So he is training in the lead up to the marathon about 140 kilometers per week. So that's a huge training volume for someone of 70 plus years of age. It's actually something we see in athletes at their peak age around the 20-30s. So that's probably one of the reasons also why he has such an exceptional running economy and exceptional performance in general. And another notable finding for both athletes actually was that they're very consistent with their training. I think that's one of the key findings that we found. So if we look at Hans, for example, in the last 25 years, he mentioned he didn't train long, like he didn't miss training for longer than a week. So he has been training 25 years essentially in a row, which is incredible to think of. And for Yo, he also trained a huge amount. And in the 2 years leading up to the marathon world record performance, he trained every single day. So again, showing the importance of consistency. So they're not doing any crazy stuff in terms of their track interval sessions or just HIIT sessions. They do some HIIT sessions, but not crazy intensities. They just make sure whatever they do, they can maintain consistently. And I think that's one of the key factors that also has allowed him to perform that well at such an age, especially because we know from some studies that at these older ages, if you get injured, performance tends to decrease quite fast. So then if you would get an injury, it's quite difficult to get back up to that level. But if you can keep training consistently, I think that really helps to ensure performance at that age level.
Yeah, 140 kilometers for what, 71 years old. That is absolutely mind blowing. But I think this is where triathletes, a lot of course we have some runners listening as well, but most of the audience is triathletes. They have an advantage in that they can get away with doing less running because they're also swimming and cycling. So you can still get a really good training volume, but maybe with less of the injury risk, because most of the injury risk comes from running because it's so high impact. Is there anything else that you would say, any other conclusions from those case studies or general practical recommendations for older athletes?
Well, perhaps one other interesting one is that both athletes started quite late with their running. So from Yo, I remember the exact age, it was 36. And from Hans, I don't remember the exact one, but it was also like later during his lifetime. So that suggests it's never too late to get started, because now they're both world-class athletes, but they started only quite late. So you could argue perhaps it's because they started a bit later that they're now world-class athletes, which is also something been discussing with them. And one of the factors you could argue there is that because they started later, they don't have any times from their peak age years, so they can't be comparing, like, I used to run 4 minutes per kilometer on my endurance run, now I'm running like 5 minutes, or I used to run 29 minutes on a 10k, whatever. So that might help them with just maintaining motivation. But anyway, I think it's just nice to see that you can start at any age and still perform very well, and perhaps even exceptionally well, such as these individuals, as long as you're just consistent with training and not doing too much crazy stuff, I guess.
That's a really interesting point about starting later. And I guess for people that did start earlier, whenever you started, just trying to mentally be okay with just performing at the level that you are right now and not thinking too much about what you did before whenever you started. So the next topic is, I guess, on the opposite side of the spectrum. So there is this concept, and I'll let you explain it, of like sensitive periods in training, and long-term athlete development model is one that has used that concept. So can you describe what we mean by that, both the sensitive periods and long-term athlete development model, and then we'll get into some follow-up questions around that.
Yeah, sure. So let's start with the sensitive periods preps. So, and then I have to give sufficient credit, I have to go back to the biology research, where they have been looking into this in singing birds, for example. And there they showed if you have a certain age within these birds, and then if they hear certain songs from their parents, for example, they learn these songs. But if they reach a certain age and haven't heard these songs, then they aren't able to learn these songs at a later age. So that suggests there is some sensitive, or in that case, actually critical periods, during which you need to have a certain experience. And if you haven't had that experience, you can't really learn it, or you can't even learn it anymore after that certain age. And this concept has been transferred a little bit as well into humans and athletic development. And it's also been influenced by some other research findings, which is just natural development. So some studies have been investigating how we naturally improve in performance in certain skills. So for example, how does vertical jump performance improve just without any training naturally due to growth and maturation in people age 7, 8, 9, 10 years of age, etc. And the same for grip strength, for flexibility measures, etc. And there we also see some variation. So as an example, speeds, just sprint speed, 10 meter sprint speed might increase most rapidly from ages 7 to 9 in boys, for example. And based on such observations, so the natural increases in speed or these let's say basic motor abilities, and this evidence from animals that there are certain critical periods, it has been hypothesized that we also have so-called sensitive periods during which we are extra sensitive to certain stimuli during the development. And if we then would do certain training stimuli, such as agility training, speed training, endurance training, flexibility training, that we would have large improvements during this time period, so during these specific ages, and thereby improve performance on the long run. So that's a bit the concept, which has also been applied in the LTAD model, so the long-term athlete development model, which is one of the most common, well-known models, I guess, to structure on how to structure athletic development in children and youth. And they suggest that for boys, for example, I think they propose two sensitive periods. I don't know the exact numbers, so I'm going to be guessing a little bit. I think it's from 7 to 9 years, they suggest, there is a sensitive period to train speed. So if you would do a lot of speed training, you would, in the long run, be better in speed sports. And there is another sensitive period from, I think it's 13 to 16 years, where, again, there is this sensitive period for speed. And then they propose some different sensitive periods as well for flexibility, for strength, for endurance, etc. Now, I found that quite interesting when I was first reading such a concept. I think as well, of course, everyone wants to know something like this. If you can have extra gains by essentially doing the same thing, just at a slightly different time period. So it's quite interesting. But again, I couldn't find any evidence in the LTED model or some of the other national governmental models that have implemented also these sensitive periods in their models. So I started quite an extensive literature just to see, can I find any evidence somewhere to support the existence of such sensitive periods. But instead of actually finding support, I only found more and more evidence that it's quite a tricky concept actually as it's being applied in these models. So one of the issues we sort of identified within our paper is that we know sports performance is quite complex. It's integrating psychological, certain physical, so biomechanical factors. And you can try and get an estimation of all these factors by trying to isolate them. So if we would do a squat, we could say with the squat, we are measuring strength, which is contributing to our sports performance. If we do some sit and reach tests, we are we might think we are assessing flexibility, and therefore that might also contribute to a performance. And if we do a Cooper test or whatever, we might measure our endurance. So essentially we are trying to get very specific measures of sport performance, which is quite complex. Now, the issue there is that these models are also trying to use such a, which is called reductionist approach, where you're trying isolate different components of performance. And then subsequently, they assume that strength, for example, that you might have in a squat is different from sprint performance. And sprint performance is different from agility performance. And then they assume again that you therefore have different underlying, let's say, neural as well, neural components that are maturing, developing, and that are more sensitive to experience. But the issue there is a bit that there are no separate neural components that are contributing to strength performance or sprint performance. We have a slightly different within our brain, for example, and also within the muscles, slightly different coordination that we're using, but it's not a completely different system. So we don't have a system for strength. We don't have a system for speed. We don't have a system for coordination. It's all within the same system. So then proposing that we have sensitive periods for these different systems is also, it doesn't really make sense actually. And that's also what we found within our review, that we didn't actually find any support that these sensitive periods as proposed in these papers are actually also backed up by any research. And I think there is even one paper, which is quite nice, where they showed that if you train speed within the proposed sensitive period, and then it's, of course, a very specific way of training speed, that was actually less effective than training speed at a younger or an even slightly older age. So again, sort of debunking that whole sensitive periods issue. So I guess there's a lot more to discuss there, but I hope that provides the essence of what we've been delving into a bit.
Yeah, it makes me think about the analogy with just like the general periodization models that we have, that it's we always want to have some kind of nice pathway or template to follow. And it's nice to think that if we do, let's say, the traditional periodization base work first, and then we gradually increase intensity and reduce volume when we get close to the races, then that's the best way to train. But now I think we also know that, well, it's really not that simple. And it's not, again, as you say, it's reductionist and trying to isolate different things that are just inherently related, I guess. So it's, but it does make me think that, I understand why people came up with that kind of concept, because it's the same reason that we came up with periodization models in the first place. But I guess we shouldn't, I guess the point is that we shouldn't necessarily, when it comes to young athletes, kids, that my parents might be listening to this and think, oh, how should my child develop if they want to be an athlete? And I guess the point is that, well, maybe not get hung up on there being an optimal way of doing things, and maybe just having fun and not overdoing things is as best as we can do at this point.
Exactly. And I think that's also one of the things we're arguing. So even if these models propose you should do speed training at a certain age, they don't provide information on how to do that speed training. Of course, we know that's going to impact also the effectiveness of such a method. And even if you shouldn't do, let's say, coordination training at a certain age, if you're doing speed training, so sprints, or if you're doing strength training, such as squats, you're also training coordination. So you can't really isolate these abilities anyway. So indeed, like you mentioned, I wouldn't bother too much. And we are always training everything. We can put a bit more emphasis on certain basic motor abilities, if you like, but I wouldn't be too focused on these sensitive periods indeed.
Yeah. All right. So let's move on to the next topic, strength and conditioning. This is again an area where you've done several reviews, I think you've done. One of them was about how to manipulate the set structures of your strength training and how that impacts the adaptations to resistance training. So can we start there? What did you find with that paper?
Yeah, so this is a nice paper led by Ivan Jukic, a colleague from New Zealand. And what we did there is, traditionally the way by which people program strength training is they do, let's say, 3 sets, and then you have per set 5 repetitions, and then you do those 5 repetitions, you take 3 minutes of rest, you do again 5 repetitions, 3 minutes of rest, and 5 repetitions. So all the rest is just between sets. And what we've been looking at here is the effect of what if you would, within each set, also take some additional rest. So that would mean instead of doing all five repetitions after each other, you would do three repetitions, then take a minute of rest, and then do the last two repetitions. So that would be the cluster training idea. And that might be something you can do in squatting, but also weightlifting and jumping, and different kind of strength training exercises. And what we saw there is that for some outcomes, such as jump performance, or let's say the more explosive-related outcomes, indeed, we see that this cluster training or rest redistribution training, where you essentially just extend also the entire training duration, is more beneficial than the traditional set structure manipulation, where you do just the five repetitions or how many you have after each other without any rest in between them. And the mechanism there, the idea is that, of course, if you give some rest in between these repetitions, your neuromuscular system recovers a bit faster. And therefore, these last two reps, for example, within the five rep example, you can perform them at a slightly higher power output, a slightly higher rate of force development. And therefore, you also train these neuromuscular qualities at a slightly you just train them slightly better, and therefore in the long run you also have better adaptations, which is also what we found in with our first review there.
And in this case, should the weight lifted be basically as high as you can lift for it to be effective? And that's why the extra recovery makes sense, because then you can probably increase the weight a little bit compared to if you did all five consecutively.
So I guess from an endurance perspective, I would anyway recommend indeed just heavy weights to be used. So in there, it's probably indeed and also beneficial to use some of this cluster training, where indeed you could opt, just like I mentioned, you might do five reps and then you do the first three, then you take a minute of a rest period, then you do the last two, and then instead of taking 4 minutes of rest between the sets, you might actually just do 3 minutes, because you already have taken that 1 minute of rest, what you normally would take between the sets within your set. And again, you could do different manipulations there. So you could also say, if I normally take 4 minutes of rest between my sets, I now take 2 minutes of that rest within my sets. So then I have 2 minutes left between the sets. Or I just maintain it at the same inter-set rest. So you could also keep it at 4 minutes, but of course that means your entire training duration will be extended. So it depends a bit on how much rest you have.
Right. And so among all of the, let's give some general recommendations, because I know you've done a lot of studies, so we're not going to get into the details of all of them, but just in terms of the practical applications, you said that heavyweight for endurance athletes. What else would you say if you're, again, consulting with somebody or coaching somebody? How would you structure a typical strength training session for them? How many exercises, how many sets and reps roughly, and any other tips that you would give?
Yeah, so I like to keep my strength training exercises typically within maximum 1 hour. So that gives me the first sort of restriction on which exercise to include and the time duration. And that typically means I include something like 3-4 different exercises. And typically I have two, let's say, heavy resistance training exercises. And then I have one or two plyometric, more oriented exercises. And it differs a bit between like sessions and stuff, but that's like my very generic answer. And then we know, for example, for the heavy resistance training exercises, we know for tendons, which is a very important adaptation that we're training with resistance training, that we need to load them very heavy, typically above 85%, 90% of the maximum voluntary contraction to achieve sufficient strain, which then leads to tendon adaptations, which is beneficial for both injury prevention in the tendon and also performance enhancement. So improving running economy, for example. And what I therefore typically recommend is to use a weight that you can lift perhaps 6 times, but then lift it until the 5th repetition. So you have 1 repetition left in reserve, essentially. So you're not training to muscle failure, which we know tends to evoke slightly more hypertrophy, which we want to avoid as endurance athletes. But we still get the same, let's say, neuromuscular stimulus strength adaptations. which of course is what we want. So that's what I'm doing for these heavy resistance exercises. And then typically I'm just using 3 up to sometimes 4 sets. And then I complement it with some plyometric exercises such as box jumps, drop jumps, etc.
With the resistance exercises, do you have any guidance around, let's say, lifting explosively or at least with explosive intent, the speed of the lift essentially?
Yeah, indeed. I'm using the intent to lift as explosively as possible. So, of course, that might mean with a heavy weight, you're still lifting very slowly in terms of velocity, but at least the intent is there to just make the concentric phase as fast as possible. And then the eccentric or lowering phase, it's typically like 2-3 seconds.
And would the exercises be or a mix of double-legged and single-legged exercises, or would you have a preference for one over the other?
I tend to do mostly sort of single-leg stuff, but it's, again, there is a reason for both. So for double-leg, we can just provide a little bit more overload in some exercises. It's a little bit more less specific. But for the single-leg stuff, it might be slightly less overload and a little bit more specific. But I tend to find that if you're, let's say, trained enough to some of these single leg exercises, there is not really a strong trade-off between how much weight you like can extra lift with a double leg exercise. So that's why I'm typically preferring a single leg exercise, such as a split step squat, for example. But with a deadlift, I find it quite tricky to do like a single leg or deadlift, something like this. So there I'm still using like a double leg deadlift. So it depends a little bit, I guess, also on the exercise I'm using.
Yeah, definitely. So if we have somebody that they can go to the gym twice a week, then maybe you can fit in, let's say, 4 of those resistance exercises, 2 in one session and 2 in the other. So if you can pick for like a generic template example of your four favorite resistance exercises that you would give to an athlete, what would those be?
Probably, I guess, a single leg squat. So I wouldn't start super heavy, but eventually, ideally, I would want to go very heavy there just to make sure we're training in terms of performance, we're training the glutes, for example, the quads, which we know from some recent research is a very effective exercise specifically for the glutes, for example, just to increase neural activation there, the voluntary activation, and also for the quads. We're training also the patella tendon, which is also in a sort of injury location that we might see in some of the endurance athletes. So it's both a performance enhancement and injury preventative exercise. Then I guess another one I would like to include is, it's super simple, but it's just a sort of calf raise isometrically. Also, again, very heavy loaded just to make sure we're training specifically the Achilles tendon, which like a lot of research supports has a very important role in the total running economy and also in terms of Achilles tendon injury prevention. So again, from both perspectives, that's quite an important exercise to include. Then I probably would include also some plyometric exercises, which we also know from research to be effective, mostly at improving performance. So that would be some drop jumps or jumps to boxes, again, with maximum intent. And then I might include some additional exercise that it could be, depending on the phase of the season, perhaps deadlifts, again, very heavy deadlift, or perhaps a step up.
All right, perfect. So then the final topic for today is around devices and technology. So you already mentioned working with one of them, an insole, and you have done quite a few bits and pieces with researching various things like smartwatches and cardiopulmonary exercise testing equipment and DFA alpha 1 and lots of other things. So as a general question around technology and devices and wearables, which of them do you think are genuinely useful for amateur runners and triathletes and can contribute to improving training and performance and recovery and things like that?
Yeah, I get that question a lot, but I keep finding it a tricky question because I never know really which ones in general I would recommend. And the reason is that as a researcher, I know for a lot of equipment how accurate they are, for example, which is for a lot of equipment where you would expect it to be accurate, it's quite inaccurate actually. So that's the first reason why I'm not too much fan of using a lot of these wearables. And then for some of the wearables where we know they're like at least reasonably accurate, then my question is always, do we really know where we should go with the data? So what's beneficial, or what are the thresholds, for example, being used within those wearables to consider like now it's good, now it isn't good. And from the research for biomechanical stuff, for example, I know we don't have those thresholds. So then my question is always, well, okay, now I can measure this very accurately, which is nice, but how does it help me? I still don't know what's good, what's not good. So that's a bit what I find tricky. But to come back a bit more to your question, so where I do think it's useful for recreational runners is simply just a heart rate belt, because there is also some anecdotal evidence to support that if you just instruct a recreational runner to go easy or to go hard, some people don't really know what's easy or what's hard, and there a heart rate belt might help them to give a bit more calibration basically to that feeling, so then they can get that feedback, okay, now is actually the feeling I'm having now that's being supported as being hard or actually as being easy. So I think that's quite useful. Just in general, I think like a watch that measures your distance and speed and pace, that's quite useful as well, just to keep track of those metrics. So you can also, with a training schedule, keep a bit more track of what you're actually doing. Let's see, something else. Ideally, something that tells you also specifically for you, I guess, how hard you're running. So are you running below your first ventilatory threshold or above the second one, for example, or below the second one? So we know that has also quite some pronounced effects on fatigue, for example. So from that perspective, it could be quite interesting, which is where initially I explored the usability of the trended fluctuation analysis, Alpha 1. And then ideally, I guess, but we don't really have that wearable yet. We're working on this, is something that also tells you your mechanical loading. So in addition to getting some kind of feedback on, let's say, metabolic loading, you also would want, at least I would want, a wearable that tells me my mechanical loading on different tissues that are commonly injured. And then ideally also tells me, well, you've now been running so long with this intensity, so now actually might be good to take a day off, or at least to perform your next day run a bit easier, because you have accumulated so much load or damage on your Achilles tendon. And we know from like a huge database or from your previous experiences that this is going to increase your risk of injury substantially, so it's best to take like a day off. But it's not there yet, but I guess that's something I also would think could be very interesting for starters as well.
So for you right now, I assume you use a watch and you use a heart rate monitor. Do you use anything else for example, with that knowing your intensity, do you use something in your day-to-day, or is it more that every once in a while you do some kind of testing to figure it out? And we can start there.
Yeah, there's also something, I guess, as a scientist, a lot of people expect me to do, like to use a lot of fancy equipment to do a lot of testing. But actually, I'm not doing that at all. And I guess one of the reasons is because I'm just too busy to do a lot of those testings. So that's actually probably the primary reason. But also because a lot of things I've tried in the past in terms of wearables, then I just tend to notice, at least for myself, is that they're not really providing any additional benefits. So as an example, even a heart rate monitor, I've been using it and still use it occasionally during my runs. But then I just find out after run, I just look at my heart rate. I'm like, okay, yeah, it's high during my intervals and it's a bit lower after my intervals. Okay, but like I don't need a heart rate belt to tell me this. And it sometimes in the past, then I'm just trying to check, you know, on days where I felt a bit subjectively less fit, for example, then my heart rate also tended to be slightly higher, for example, or lower in some occasions as well. And I guess in the beginning, it has helped me to gain a little bit of insight into, again, just be aware of some of these feelings. So just calibrating your feeling again. But at some point it didn't provide any additional benefit. And it's the same with the detrended fluctuation analysis, for example, been also trying this out, but there the issue is it's not really working well consistently during running, quite a bit of technical challenges during the bike. It might be a bit better. But that's something I keep finding out with a lot of these technologies, then it's interesting for like a few sessions, but then I'm like, okay, now I've gotten sort of that insight, but now how can it still be providing me with any extra value? I should know there that I think that's partly because I'm just training a lot. I've been training for years, and then you just know your body quite well by then. So for some recreation athletes, I've been discussing before, some of these wearables might be at least usable or for longer time periods. But if you're training, it's like a sort of high level for a long time period, I think you know your body quite well. And there, I think the added benefit of such wearables, at least in my opinion, becomes much lower. And also I'm training myself, so I know exactly what I've been doing, how I've been feeling. But if I would be training someone else, or if I would have a coach, then I can imagine it's also much more useful to have those wearables, because then you have some more objective data to share with anyone, and then you can make some more informed decisions based on this. But because I'm training myself, I've been feeling how I feel, and I don't need to like to have some other tool to tell me this again. So again, I would like to have some tools at some point that provide me with very specific information. Where am I running in terms of my thresholds and what's the mechanical loading? But I'm not sure we are at that point yet that we have a wearable that, or separate wearables that can do this with the accuracy that I would want it to be, actually.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to clarify. Like, if you think that if these devices is something that you're currently using because they are there and they're good enough, but it sounds like that's not really the case. So it's more of a wish list for maybe we will get there in the next few years. But yeah, I completely agree with what you say there. But I think, as you said there at the end, with if you have a coach, then I can speak as a coach. I would like to see heart rate and pace and RPE from all the training. Then even if I don't necessarily want the athlete to look at their watch if they're doing an easy run or an easy bike ride, they can just go out and do it. But to have it to look at it is helpful, because then when you can triangulate those three heart rate and pace / power and RPE, then you can basically get 99% of the information from those three variables, I think.
Yeah, I fully agree. Yeah. Yeah. And perhaps just to add that, I think if you have sufficient time, then I think combining at least some of the accurate wearables that might, perhaps we don't know how they might be used, but at least by measuring them over a long time period, we might gain some insights into what would be working good for performance, what's not working good. But it just takes a lot of time, and that's, I guess, one of the reasons why I'm not using anything now, because I just don't have the time to measure all these things consistently, and then, well, especially to take a look back and try and figure out where, like, did I go wrong or could have improved a bit more.
Exactly. No, definitely. And just one more follow-up. You mentioned that DFA Alpha 1 might work better on the bike, but I actually tried it quite relatively recently, maybe a year ago, on the bike and even on the indoor trainer, where it should be the most accurate because there's no outside, disturbance. You're in the same position and you have constant light and all of that. So, but it didn't even work there for me with the technology set that I used, at least. So I quickly gave up on that, even though I was quite interested in it. But yeah, I don't think it worked well.
No, it's the same for me. And also, it's not really consistent. And I guess it's partly just due to technological issues. It's very sensitive to just missing one heartbeat, and then you have quite an impact if you're not filtering that correctly with the value that you're getting. And we also have something submitted now that is not only sensitive to your thresholds, but also just to overall fatigue. So that means if you're a bit fatigued, then it's also impacting the values that you're getting. So in that sense, it's, if you want to use it as, let's say, a training intensity tool, it would only work if you're completely fresh. But if you're fatigued, then sort of the intensity values that you're getting are also impacted by fatigue. So you don't know that anymore. Am I training below my first threshold, below the second one? Because then you have fatigue also impacting those values. So that's, again, making it quite tricky.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I know we're running low on time, so let's finish up with the rapid fire questions. So take just one sentence to answer each of these. And the first one is, what's your favorite book or resource related to endurance sports?
I think that's by far still the book by French Bosch. It's, I'm not sure the English name actually, but I think it's called Running and Biomechanics. And I think it's probably about 10 years ago when I was still going on training camps a lot. I think I brought it 5 times on my training camp, and just in between the training sessions, I just kept reading it, and I just still find it just a super interesting book to understand on a fundamental biomechanical and also, yeah, mostly biomechanical level. Why are we running the way we're running, and how can we understand how muscles are functioning? What are the implications for strength training and also some, let's say, running drills? So I've just found it very fascinating book.
Yeah, that's a good one. And what's an important habit that you've benefited from athletically, personally, or professionally?
I think planning in my training sessions as at least in an attempt as the first thing in the day, and then trying to structure my day around that as much as possible, because then I know my training sessions give me some kind of structure. And also I just tend to notice on days where I'm not training, which is like only actually occurring in tapering week or something, my focus is just completely gone. So for some reason, I just really need a training stimulus. So initially, I was still thinking it's taking up time, like all the training. But I just more and more keep finding out that even though it's taking time, the time that I have to work is just much more efficiently. So I'm actually getting much more done in a day, even though I have less hours in a day to work. So that's quite, yeah, an interesting and something that might help other people as well, to just try and make sure, try and get that exercise in. Gives you less time, but the hours that you have are actually spent much more efficient.
Yeah, I completely agree with you there. I think exactly the same. And it's surprising initially when you find it, when you get injured and you think that you'll get so much work done. I had a bike crash this weekend and I was thinking that, oh, well, great, I'll get a lot of work done. But actually then you find that, well, the productivity is not as high as when you're training. So it's still the same amount of work that you managed to do.
Exactly. It's, well, at least for me, it works like one day and then it really starts to decline. So one day I'm super productive still, but yeah, it doesn't work long.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Bas, so much. Just final question and I'll let you go. Where can the listeners follow you?
I'm on Twitter, so it's just my handle. I think it's at Bas van Horen. I'm also on LinkedIn, on Facebook. But that's also it. Like, not on Instagram and all the other stuff. It's just getting too much for me. Yeah, but at least on Twitter, I'm quite active.
Great. All right. Thank you so much. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes for this episode on scientifictriathlon.com. And just as a quick follow-up on the topic about the older world-class runners, we weren't sure at the time of recording what their PBs actually were, but the full-text articles are available, and I have put links for them in the show notes, so you can check out the entire article. I have looked through them to check what were the times actually that these runners set, and for the marathon world record holder in the 70 to 74 age group, that was the 71-year-old, his marathon world record was 2:54.19, and his personal best of all time was 2:41.01 at the age of 54. So that shows you how much of his old PB he managed to retain even 17 years later. Then on the other hand, the middle distance runner, the 75-year-old, had the world record for the mile in the 75 to 79 age group, and his mile world record was 5:41. He also had top results, not world records, but world ranking top results in the 75 to 79 age group for the 800. His PB there, or his age category PB there, was 2:34, and for the 1500 it was 3:30, but that is almost exactly the same pace as the mile, or very small difference anyway. That gives you an idea of the level of these runners, and it is really very inspiring to hear about these times at the ages that these runners were. But I'll have lots of links to different articles and publications that we discussed in the show notes, so you can check them out. It's also worth going to Bas' website, basvanhoren.com. I'll link to that as well. He has written some really nice articles that concisely summarizes some of these studies that he's been worked on. So that's that's a really nice resource as well to look into if you want to dig a bit deeper. Now, I want to just give you another reminder about our 2024 training camp in Mallorca. This will be in April, and you can find all of the information on scientifictriathlon.com/Mallorca. There you can also find testimonials that we have from participants of our previous editions of the camp. So check them out, because that will give you a really good perspective of all the different reasons to join our camp. But just to read out one example, one participant said, quote, "It was simply fantastic. The setup with coaches and guides, the people, the resort, the food, the island, and even the weather. It was a memorable week, and I can't wait to do it again already," end quote. So if you're interested in an experience like this, check out scientifictriathlon.com/Mallorca and follow the instructions there to register, or email me directly on michael@scientifictriathlon.com. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Form, that you can find on formswim.com/TTS. Improve your swim training with real-time metrics like pace, stroke rate, and heart rate, and advanced post-swim analysis. Use the code TTS15 to get 15% off the Form Smart Swim Goggles. And thank you to Zenate. Use the Zenate swim trainer to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. Even if you have just 15 minutes at home available, you can get a time-efficient Zenate workout done at home that will help you swim better and stronger. You can try the Zenate risk-free for up to 30 days and get 20% off your first order on zenateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.